Online, on digital, and on 103.5 FM. This is 3MBS Fine Music Melbourne.
Welcome to Reflections. I'm Doug Beecroft. How lucky we are to have one of Australia's most elegant heritage properties, a classically inspired Italianate mansion, sited in magnificent gardens, just an hour's drive from Melbourne. That's Bulloora House and Garden on the Mornington Peninsula, and the name Bulloora is synonymous with its director and trustee, Anthony Knight. Anthony was on the board of the National Trust Victoria for 30 years and held positions as Vice President and Vice Chair. He's also chaired the National Trust Collections Committee and was the Trust Representative on the Heritage Council of Victoria. Previously, Anthony was Director of the Johnson Collection in East Melbourne. In 2007, he was awarded an OAM for service to heritage, conservation and the arts in Victoria. Welcome to Reflections, Anthony.
Thank you very much. I thought you were going to describe me as an elegant man, but you went off to describe an elegant
Describe the building. Oh, I think they both apply, Anthony. You clearly have a great appreciation for the beauty of the past, and you have been painstaking and meticulous in your approach to preservation. What rewards do you find in preserving our past?
Oh, the ability to be able to pass something on to the future, because I don't believe that you know where you've been or going until you know where you've been. And the past has always fascinated me for that reason, although I find the future very exciting too. And so what happens with all sorts of things, like even music, in the next many years, I wish I would be around to see, but sadly probably won't.
Well, we hope you're around for a long time ahead. Let's go to your first piece of music, Anthony. It's by Mozart, and it's O Tremble Not from The Magic Flute, the Queen of the Night's aria. Why have you chosen this?
It was one of those productions I saw years ago when we went to the opera before I fell asleep before the first act opened. But I remember, and I can't remember who it was, but I remember seeing and hearing it rather than just hearing it, with this wonderful person striding along, womanhood at her best, singing her heart out and sort of almost sweeping everything before her. Now, whether that's what the story's all about, I don't really know, but that's how it sort of struck me at the time.
That sounds pretty like the Queen of the Night to me. And here's Sumi Jo to sing it.
Thank you.
Queen of the Night's aria from The Magic Flute by Mozart, sung by Sumi Jo with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra under the direction of Sir George Scholte. And that was chosen by Anthony Knight, director and trustee of Ballura House. Thank you, Anthony. Now, let's talk about your life and your career. I've got a mental image of you. I see you as a little boy exploring beautiful old buildings with your grandfather. And I heard you in an interview talking about this, and in particular visiting Ripon Lee. Can you share a bit of that about your explorations with your grandfather?
Well, he was an extraordinarily gifted man at getting to know people, and somehow he got to know either Louisa Jones from Ripon Lee or the head gardener, but he was a mad gardener, so it was possibly the gardener. Anyway, he loved taking me to marvellous and discovering marvellous old houses and gardens and buildings. But he took me to Ripon Lee, and the first visit, I remember being somewhat overawed and terrified by this immense house in this extraordinary garden. And it wasn't exactly neglected, but it wasn't like it is today. It was a lived-in garden. And then, of course, I was sent off to play, as you do. And I just rambled around in that enormous garden by myself, and it was like being in some sort of dream, I suppose, when I think about it. And one day Mrs. Jones appeared, and she always called me boy, and would the boy like some lemonade? And of course the boy would have loved some lemonade, so off I went to the kitchens, which are not the ones that are in the basement, the old ones, but somewhat more modern 1950s ones. And I remember them being sort of deserted and cool, and this jug of obviously homemade lemonade.
It sounds as you had a great sense of place then in absorbing your surroundings. What were your surroundings like? Did you grow up in opulence yourself?
No,
what was your family?
No,
like?
Not really. My father was a hosiery manufacturer, and we always seemed to be better off than most people and always seemed to have nicer cars, but I don't ever remember being particularly influenced one way or the other. My parents were remarkably detached from their children in a strange way. I'm sure they loved us, but they never really cuddled us or anything like that. And we didn't grow up in opulence at all in that sense. But I always enjoyed Country Life magazine, that English magazine, which my grandfather seemed to subscribe to because they're always around in his house. And reading those, you can't not be attuned to the beautiful things of the world.
Something has happened to you between those early years of absorbing these beautiful surroundings with your grandfather and having an eye for these magazines and getting to the board of the National Trust where you stayed for 30 years. Mm. Was there education that followed for you? Was it a specialist education that you had later on?
No, not really at all. I left school and an uncle of mine obtained for me a job with, I can't remember now which came first, Meyer or B. Taplin. I think it was B. Taplin, who was an interior decorator in South Yarra, and he must have known her. And I was sent to see her, which I did. And then she said, would I like to start next year, which I did. It was the end of the year before. And then when I got to the place, there's a sort of rather tattered note attached to the door that said, Anthony, go and see the bank manager next door, which I duly did. And he handed me a key and said, well, you know, young man, go to it. She was on holiday somewhere and she didn't appear for 6 weeks. And so when I got to this place, there were notes saying what I had to do, where I had to go. And with the car, the key to the car, and, you know, off I did.
And clearly you did it very well.
Well, I don't know whether I did it well, but I did it. And then she reappeared, and she was this wonderful person who was across between Kay Kendall and Auntie Mame. And you just fell for her like, you know, a ton of bricks, which I did at the time. She was quite wonderful. One of the Faulkner family, wool families. And she also was a screen printer and printed fabric.
How did you get involved in the National Trust?
Well, I think, honestly, my grandfather must have been a member or must have known about it. I sort of went to things, and he took me to Como when I was 15 or so, when it just opened. And then I attempted to join the Young Trust, but they were frightfully snooty, and there were all these nice chaps standing around in cravats, and we were meant to be on a working bee, as I recall.
Like they'd be much use.
No. Well, one, the particular person in the cravat became one of my best friends later on, but I think that's where I started. And then one day somebody said, you know, you really should stand for the board. So I went overseas, and when I came back, I had stood for the board and I was on the board, believe it or not.
Were there some marvellous donations or properties passed to the trust, artworks, collections in your time? Anything that particularly stands out?
Well, lots and lots. But there was an amazing couple of chaps who lived in a house, I'll say Moorabbin, somewhere like that, and they had a fairly simple timber house which they'd converted into a Greek temple. They had sort of columns and things, and then they'd taken most of the walls out from the inside, and it was like being in a railway carriage full of the most incredible furniture and glass and pianos, including the Norwood stained glass windows which the Trust has, which are phenomenal.
Well, that sounds like you were linked to some very interesting and eccentric people.
Well,
wonderful.
And yes, and had a lot of fun.
Anthony, we've come to your next choice of music, and it's the slow movement we're going to play from the Max Bruch Violin Concerto. Now, this is something that you remember from an early age.
My parents sat at night and listened to records, as there was no television, and both of them obviously liked classical music. And I remember creeping out of bed in the middle of the night and listening to this, sort of hiding in the hallway as they're obviously playing it. It was years later that I got a record and actually realised what it was, because as a child I didn't really know, I suppose.
Thank you.
Nikolai Scheps-Snyder, playing the violin with the London Philharmonic Orchestra under Lawrence Foster, playing the slow movement from the Violin Concerto No. 1 by Max Bruch. And thanks very much, Anthony Knight, for that choice. When we visit Ballura, we are visiting the world of John Tallis, Ballura being the homestead in Mornington where John Tallis lived. Can you tell us about John Tallis? And in fact, you got to know him quite well.
I came across him when I was at the Johnson Collection, when he came one day and said that he had a house and that's what he wanted to do with it. Then I was invited to visit, and then put off, and then again and again, because there were reasons which I found out later. And I went down to see him and thought, well, you don't have a Johnson Collection house because it's a house full of all sorts of funny things. But I found it a bit of magic. It took me back to my grandfather, you know, getting into amazing houses. And he was very old-fashioned. I sometimes used to think of him almost as the last Edwardian, always sort of impeccably but very casually dressed, in the sense that he seemed to wear clothes just very naturally, but always jackets and things. He was quite passionate about a lot of things, terribly pessimistic. A lot of his friends, I didn't find him gloomy, as they called him, but a lot of his friends referred to him as Mr. Gloom. He was startlingly handsome, even in old age.
He was reclusive.
He wasn't reclusive.
That's his reputation.
Everybody says he was a recluse. He just didn't like the modern world. But if you were a friend, or if he knew you, or you're part of his world, he was very open and bubbly and, you know, welcoming. But I suppose the modern world didn't exactly suit him.
For 50 years, he lived like that and worked away at Ballura, the house that he absolutely loved and created it the way he wanted. But that's not the way he started. He spent the early part of his life in, you know, rather bohemian Paris and London. And tell us about that.
To some extent, I mean, he grew up in enormous affluence because his father was extremely rich. And they lived in an astonishing house in Toorak called Grosvenor, which is 7 acres of gardens around it. And Ballura was their summer place. He went to Geelong Grammar, and then his father hoped that he might have a successor in this amazing business he'd built up, which, of course, was J.C. Williamson's. So he was shipped off to Paris and told to learn to drive a motor car and to learn some languages and become his father's apprentice. And it was Paris of the 20s. The Depression changed it. His parents came back and he stayed there, and then moved out of, you know, the rather nice part he was living in, and of necessity, I suppose, economy, moved into the 1920s Paris. And nobody knows what he got up to, which is the most frustrating thing, because he obviously must have been influenced. I tracked all the places he lived because periodically he had to write back to dear father for more money. So I had the addresses and I tracked all of those around Paris, and they're very nice, well, had been very nice areas, but it was still pretty bohemian.
And a far cry from the lifestyle that he later had.
Yes, yes. He came back to Australia during the war and was in the army for a period. And then at the end of the war, I suspect he planned on going back to Europe, starting his musical career, because he was a composer, as you may know, and a pianist. Somehow Ballura sort of got its tentacles into him, and he became more and more obsessed with Ballura. And he saw it as, I don't think he ever really enjoyed it. Whether he loved it or hated it, I don't know. But he saw it as a duty of care. And he often said that he wanted to create a memorial to his father.
It sounds like a purpose. And you've mentioned his father. Let's look at Sir George Tallis. What an interesting man, and what an interesting career, and the associates that he created during his career. Two come to mind: Sarah Bernhardt and Nellie Melba. I mean, this is quite big-time career, isn't it?
Yes, well, he travelled the world and brought some of the best of the world back to Australia. He also had theatres in other parts of the world as well. It was an enormous empire he built. The connection with Melba is interesting because he was obviously quite close to her, a business partner and I suspect friend, and a lot of this was doubted for a while, but we found letter books which have copies of letters he wrote to her enclosing checks for her share of the business pursuits that they got up to together. She often stayed with them and I suspect probably terrified John Tallis, but I don't really know.
I've got here a list of things he was involved in. He was treasurer of the Theatre Royal and the Princess Theatre, partner of J.C. Williamson's. He took over the firm. He gave a large amount of money to Melbourne University Conservatorium of Music. He was the director of radio station 3LO.
Well, he started radio 3LO and the ABC, which was, that's what 3LO became, the ABC.
Well, this is an astonishing man.
Plus Hoyt's Picture Theatres.
with the Thrings.
The Thrings, and was getting involved in television.
Yes, well, it's a very interesting period, isn't it? And marvellously interesting man. Your next choice of music I find interesting because it's the, we're going to hear the opening titles from the film The Leopard.
Right.
And it seems to have some relevance, the leopard being, describing a central character inhabiting a fading past.
Well, that John was Tallis? Very much John Tallis, I think. I first became aware of The Leopard in my early 20s. And the film, and it was almost a cult. People used to go, you know, once a week to The Leopard, and it was a very long film. And I've read the book 105 times. One day I was walking with John Tallis, and I don't remember what he was saying, but all of a sudden I thought, you are an Australian version of The Leopard. And I turned around and confronted him, and I said, you are an Australian version of The Leopard. And he went so bright red and looked so incredibly uncomfortable, I suddenly realised that I think I might have nailed him.
You nailed it.
And the next time I was at Ballura, he didn't say much about it, but the next time I was at Ballura, the copy, the first edition copy, I sort of noticed a fairly distinctive cover on the shelf. And after that, we talked about The Leopard quite a bit. And then when the biography of the man who wrote it came out, he sent me a copy of those things. He used to send me copies of interesting books like the diaries of the Englishman, James Lees Milne. And he would order them from the Hill of Content and have Michael deliver them personally.
Of course.
Don't think that actually happens to many people. I think he was quite fascinated by this man who would telephone and require a book to be delivered.
Here we have the opening titles to the film The Leopard.
Thank you.
the opening titles to the film The Leopard by Nino Rota. The La Scala Philharmonic Orchestra was directed by Riccardo Muti. You're listening to Reflections on 3MBS Fine Music Melbourne. I'm Doug Beecroft, and my guest is the director and trustee of Bulura House and Garden, Anthony Knight. Well, Anthony, it's time that we visited Bulura now, so that's what we'll do. When John Tallis was there, he had very particular routines that he followed in Bulura. He used different rooms for different purposes, different times of the day. Can you walk us through some of those rooms and how he used them?
Well, his favourite room in the house was the library, and he liked to be there around 4 o'clock if he wasn't going for a walk at the time. And he said he liked that room because it was the only room that didn't require a discipline. The study, where he attended to his personal correspondence, which was around 11, was a discipline. The music room, which probably was the main used room in the house, meant the discipline of practice and learning and composition. The kitchen, of course, meant the discipline of, you know, washing the dishes and so on and so on. And so you could ring him at certain times of the day and kind of know where he was at that particular time of the day, because all of these rooms, and Bulura has a lot of little rooms, had a purpose in his life. His share portfolio was looked after in what is really a storeroom off the back courtyard. Another part of the house he converted in the winter to a flat. He called it his Cotswold's Cottage. He found that running the house was expensive, heating it, and so he decided to economise. And so he converted what were the old laundries and servants' rooms into a small flat. And he would move there, make lists of what he took, move his small Beale piano, his books, and he very rarely would go into the main house during that time. He was there in the winter, a couple of months. And if he did, he found the house, of course, very cold and damp. Mm. And one of his diary entries says, went into the big house for something, caught a chill, won't be returning until, you know, whether he's moving back. And then the diary would start saying, can't wait to move back because I'm a bit cramped down here, and so on and so on. And at one time in the summer, he decided that perhaps a holiday would be nice. So he erected a tent in the courtyard and spent a month in a tent in the courtyard, only using the house as the bathroom in the house. And the telephone was connected. And the following year, he enjoyed it so much, the following year he got a bigger tent. Then he had to build a building to put all this stuff in because there was special furniture made for it and all sorts.
The house is a series of interconnecting rooms, which makes it quite unusual. It's absolutely beautiful to visit and walk through. Each room has a distinctive character and is full of the most wonderful fabrics, furnishings, artworks, and the gardens are full of statuary. He collected a lot of this when he went back to Europe, that visit in 1953 when he went to Italy.
I think at that stage he was thinking, well, I'm going back, I'm not coming back. And he was more European than Australian anyway. And he went to Florence and he wrote to his brother saying, I have brought a few things in Florence and I hope my checks are being met. And somehow or other he seemed to turn around, the sentiment turned around, and suddenly he kept referring to Bulura as his villa, right. Bulura. And he hadn't seen a like of his villa Bulura anywhere in Italy, which is a real stretch. In Venice, he went to an antique dealer and bought a number of antique statues. How on earth you got them out in those days, I don't know. But Dorian Le Gallien's partner was in the customs department or something, and or foreign service, and somehow I think it was arranged through that. But he bought quite a lot of stuff in Italy for his house, came back, commissioned all the ceiling paintings, which were to be much more extensive than they turned out to be, and then in actual fact never left Bulura again.
That sounds like the period when he was actually starting to really own Bulura as his purpose in life.
Well, perhaps understand his duty of care.
Yes.
And I think that's what was behind so much of it, that duty of care.
A favourite room of mine is the Dame Nellie Melba room. Can you describe it?
The bedroom. Well, it is furnished with furniture which was in the house because we have other pieces of it and the family continually giving back pieces. It was made by Rock, which was a furniture manufacturer in early Melbourne. But he painted it all cream because he was going very modern, and then had sort of fairly modern Sanderson linens and so on put there. People remark about the small, narrow beds, but beds were small and narrow in those days. And when people remark about it, I've often wondered why, but people didn't shower as often, so people perhaps were a bit more smelly at night than they were they are these days. I don't know. And they also say that the bed's very high off the ground, but beds were in those days. For what reason, I don't know.
There's a bath.
Oh, yes. And then, of course, there's the bathroom. Now, the story goes that Nellie Melba loved visiting Ballura because it had this enormous seawater bath. Seemingly, Sir George installed it. The bath is a massive insulated iron bath, and so it holds the heat quite well. And seawater would be pumped up from the bay, fed into the boilers, fed into the bath, and then, of course, there had to be fresh water and so on. So there would be two or three servants running around turning off stopcocks and turning on taps to feed this water into this one room. And then at the end of it all, of course, all that seawater had to go back down to the beach, otherwise it would kill the garden or where it was let out. And there were enormous cast iron pipes running all the way down to the beach, which one of our neighbours suddenly discovered when they were remaking their driveway. And, of course, that's industrial and, you know, social history, and Heritage Victoria would have stopped everything.
Yes. Mm. It's time that we have a look at your next choice of music, Anthony, and it's by Schubert, and it's the first movement of the Trout Quintet. Now, this is a family favourite, I believe.
Well, my mother and her mother both were mad about Schubert, and particularly this piece. My mother, when she had it as a CD and played it so often, it kind of wore out, and she was deaf anyway, so it was always on so loud, it was unbelievable. But one day, she lived opposite St. John's in Toorak, and one day there was a funeral, and I said to her, nothing much, what would you like for your funeral? And she said, absolutely nothing but a performance of The Trout. And so that's exactly what we did.
What good taste.
Mm.
the first movement of Schubert's Piano Quintet in A, the Trout. Piers Lane was playing with members of the Golden, the Quartet, and Alex Henery, double bass. And that was recorded for 3MBS back in 2009. Thank you to our guest, Anthony Knight, who's trustee and director of Bulura House and Garden. And we're going to talk now, Anthony, about your team of volunteers and how the tours are run. Can you tell us, you have a number of volunteers, very enthusiastic, wonderful people who make us very welcome.
We do, and they do make people very welcome. And we never let them go, no matter how, I won't say old and decrepit they come, because, you know, we're all getting old and decrepit. But even when they don't do so much, we like to have them around because they make people feel wonderfully welcome and warm, and it's like family. And I think that's what Bulura is, and that's what makes it so interesting. It's not cold, hard, you know, pay your money and have a look and go.
Well, we really do share in a bit of old world. As John Tallis lived it, we feel as though we're getting to know him as we're getting to know the place, don't we?
Yes, it's sort of not the real world, I often say.
And to get there, people assemble at the Mornington Golf Club.
Yes, and we pick you up or pick people up in a little blue bus. We have two of them. A lot of the permit is a bit restrictive, but it works two ways. People don't just walk off the street, so they do have to plan to come. And when they come, of course, we are glad to see them. Whereas if we were just open to the public and you could stroll off the street, perhaps that you may not be so, well, I don't know.
It makes it special, doesn't it? Yeah. Now, a big part of Bulura is the wonderful Tallis Pavilion and the music program that you run there. So this is a big enticement for people to come to hear some wonderful, serious music in a beautiful setting.
Well, John Tallis said that he would like Bulura to be something like Glyndebourne. Not as big, he once said, because he'd never have enough money to do that. And so we, for a short while, had music outside in the garden, and we would have three performances over a weekend, and there would be one perfect day, perfect night, one too hot, and it always rained on one of them.
Yes.
And on odd occasions, people were sort of sloshing around in inches of water. The sort of next couple of years, we hired large marquees, and one of the worst storms we had, they were really sitting in 6 inches of water because we used an old tennis court for it. We had to carry the singers in, actually physically carry them in, and their makeup ran because they got wet, and then the tent leaked on top of them, and it was, anyway. So we decided to build a building on the tennis court to house all of us, which is the Tallis Pavilion. And I, you know, drew up sort of what I wanted and went to an architect, and I said, and it also has to be perfect acoustics. And Mockers, an architect, once told somebody who told me that to get great acoustics, you have something that looks like a shoebox with a peaked ceiling and a hard wall and a soft wall and so on. And that's pretty much what we did. And the acoustics have turned out to be extraordinarily good. And we have two of the best pianos in the world.
Yes, one of Stuart
which
and
is,
Sons.
Yeah, one of which is the amazing Stuart and Sons Wayne Stewart pianos, but one of them is actually, and I blush to say it, but is the biggest piano in the world.
And this is called the Bulura.
Yes, Wayne Stewart wanted to call it the Big Bulura, but that just was too much.
No.
And I often think that John Tallis would be actually horrified if he knew he owned the biggest piano in the world. But it is a fabulous instrument, and it does sound amazing. And I'm beginning to be able to recognise a Stewart piano when I hear them elsewhere. And I also have the awful experience of going to other places and hearing other pianos and thinking, oh, cripes.
Yes. Well, it is a special piano. I mean, it's hugely weighty, 3 metres in length. It took 18 months to build. It's made from Tasmanian hewn pine.
Yes,
it's very beautiful to look at too, isn't it?
Mm.
Now, you also have a relationship with ANAM, the Australian National Academy of Music, which works very well with these performances.
Yes, because they're young and they don't get scared by all these extra notes and things. John Tallis used to help young creative people, musicians, through Max Cook, always anonymously. And we thought that seeing he'd left a foundation to care for Bulura, if there was ever, you know, sufficient money, it would be nice to help young creative people. And that's how that program came to happen with Anam. We initially, well, Max Cook found people. Matthew Cam was one of the ones he found. And we felt it would probably be better to spread that wider and then also suggest strongly that they performed. And that's what Anam is all about. You have to perform. You can't be a musician and sit in a, you know, quiet room and not play a piano. And you have to be able to perform in public and be a bit of a showman.
Well, Anam has the elite young musicians of Australia, so these are fantastic performances. And at the end of it all, you get the chance to enjoy a really good Arvo tea with the musicians and often with yourself as well. And meet other people and have a thoroughly nice morning tea.
Afternoon tea. We do. I often think that if you invite people into a house, you need to say, would you like some coffee or drink or whatever? And that's what and why we do that.
So, Anthony, let's look at how do we book for a tour or a concert. There's a phone number, 5975 2027, or you can go to bloora.org.au.
And you can book online. It's quite easy. Or you can telephone if you'd like to speak to a real person.
Now, we're talking about Big Bloora before. You've chosen a great big work to finish your music selections, and that is the finale to the Organ Symphony of Camille Saint-Saëns.
Oh, right.
Why have you chosen this?
Well, a close friend of mine who's since died introduced me to this, and I remember then getting the record and wearing the thing out, and it's the organ. It's that sort of marvellous swelling thing. I saw it once at the Melbourne Town Hall and was overwhelmed, and I introduced my mother to it, and she hadn't ever heard it, which was a shock, and I was so pleased because she was the sort of person who would say, of course, dear, you do know who that was if something came on the radio and you said that was nice. And I never did, but still. So it became one of my mother's favourites too.
Gillian Weir playing the organ and the Ulster Orchestra under Jan Pascal Tourtellier in the finale to the Symphony No. 3 in C minor by Camille Saint-Saëns, the Organ Symphony. Thank you, Anthony Knight, for another fabulous choice. Heritage is more than buildings and gardens for you. It also seems to show, you also seem to show a great deal of respect for the people of the past and especially the previous owners at Ballura. Is this an important element for you?
I think so. I like creating things and building things and creating gardens, and I think people who do it, you should respect. I also think it's fascinating that most people spend most of their life working hard to provide themselves with a nice house. Yes. And the things in it. It's a strange thing. When you think about it, the house is the biggest purchase anybody probably ever makes, and what they do and how they furnish it, they put more of their effort into than pretty much anything else.
And it can rather define them, can't it?
And it does define them, yes. Yes. If you have a sort of scrappy house and the pictures are crooked and the garden's a bit unkempt, well, you know.
And Ballura partly defines you because you had a big part in redoing the gardens in the style of previous owners.
Yes, I'm glad you added that, because Ballura, inside and outside, is not my taste at all.
What is your taste?
Well, I like old things and beautiful things, pictures mainly. I think what's hanging on the walls is pretty important. I'm not mad on cluttered gardens, although I seem to have created a very cluttered one for myself quite recently. But if I owned Ballura, I perhaps would have painted it all white and hung fantastic contemporary pictures in it.
You've been very respectful.
Well, it's his house. It had to reflect him totally. And because it was so unusual to have survived this 1950s thing of how people handled inherited houses. And they're really doing it, well, whether consciously, but what they were doing was saying, I didn't have to buy my own furniture. I inherited it. So he kept his father's inherited pictures pretty much where they were, and then added his more modern pictures into the scheme.
Let's talk about your modern pictures, because you and your wife run a gallery, the Alkeston Gallery in Carlton, and it's an Indigenous gallery.
In Fitzroy.
Fitzroy,
it's, my wife was overseas at one stage many, many years ago, and I walked past the Victorian Painters Society, that one in East Melbourne, where Melba actually started off upstairs teaching, and that's where our other little piano comes from. And I went in, and there was a Gabriel Pitsey exhibition of Indigenous art, and I was bowled over and brought a couple. And my wife came back, and when I picked her up at the airport, I think I said something like, I hope you haven't spent too much money, because, you know, I've brought these pictures. And she said, I told her, and she said, well, I was thinking of looking into that sort of thing, because she'd read something in a Qantas magazine about Indigenous art.
There you go.
And then we moved into an apartment building opposite an extraordinary lady, Margaret Carnegie, and she was one of the absolute founders, creators of this market by supporting it very early on. And she had brought it this same exhibition. And when we were moving in, we had them delivered, but she had hers delivered by the same carrier at the same time. And so they arrived in the foyer, and she came out and said, yes, darlings, bring them all in here. And I was thinking, oh, no, some of those are mine. We became very close friends after that, and shared an interest and collected Indigenous art. And then, as people do, they said, you know, can you get us some? And so it grew into a gallery. And now it's my wife who sort of has done all of this, but she's probably created the most respected Indigenous gallery in the country.
Well, you sound like a very powerful team, because you're a wonderful custodian of that legacy at Ballura, and between you, you're doing a wonderful job with that Indigenous art, and I think in helping to make the world a more beautiful place.
Well, I hope so.
And that, I would say, is quite important for you.
Very much, yes.
Thank you very much, Anthony Knight, for joining us at 3MBS. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise.
And thanks also to our sound engineer, Joe Goffin, and also to our executive producer, Nikki Gilderdale. I'm Doug Beecroft.